introduction. This is Mrs. Connie Paladinich. Thank you.
I think I can say probably I'm the oldest one in the room today, but I'm still here. And I'm going to have to tell you that it's kind of hard to get off the train because there's so much stuff that is just coming across the board that is so exciting. We're having too good of a time to step off the train at this point in time. So, guys, Jeff had a very, very interesting talk, and I'm sure your minds are going in circles. So now, if you'll fasten your seatbelts, we're going to talk about another topic that does have a tendency to be a little bit confusing. First of all, can everyone hear me in the back? Okay, if you can't, just throw something or whatever. So what we're going to do for the next hour or so is to spend some time talking about lung function testing. Certainly, how many of you guys here today had the pleasure of experiencing the pulmonary rehab audits, or pulmonary purgatory, as I like to call it? Okay, well, certainly those of you who have got more than just a small dose of pulmonary function testing. So we're going to try to focus so that after the talk today, you're going to have a pretty good idea of what's going on with lung function testing. So basically, I think one of the first things that we need to do when we're using pulmonary function tests is we need to have a basic understanding of what are the benefits and what are the limitations of pulmonary function testing. They're not the be-all, end-all for everything. But I think if we're going to do them, we need to be able to use them. And we need to understand what we're looking at. So as far as benefits, pulmonary function tests are useful for diagnosing causes of unexplained respiratory symptoms, for monitoring patients with known diseases, and also, we can use those to identify patterns of severity of an abnormality. As far as limitations go, pulmonary function tests generally can't help us distinguish among the potential causes of the abnormalities when they're used alone. So basically, what I'm trying to say there is pulmonary function tests are a tool. And it's just a tool. It's just one of the tools that we need to use when we're working with our patients. Pulmonary function tests do need to be interpreted within the context of the situation where you're using them. So just to look at a set of numbers with no additional information is going to limit the usefulness of a pulmonary function test. We also need to take into consideration the patient's history, a physical examination, and any other ancillary diagnostic tests that may have been performed. As far as indications for pulmonary function testing go, what we actually do is we use those tests to evaluate symptoms and signs of lung disease. In other words, somebody has a cough that's gone on for 6 months or so. They're short of breath. They may have cyanosis, wheezing, hyperinflation, hypoxia, hypercapnia, many of those signs and symptoms. We also need to use pulmonary function testing to help us assess the progression of lung disease. And one of the things that I will tell you is, just as with, and I won't get on my 6-minute walk test soapbox, because I think you've heard enough of it. Dave spent quite a bit of time, I think last week, talking about 6-minute walk. But basically, my condensed version of my 6-minute walk soapbox is, those tests are important, very useful, especially in the pulmonary population. But just like pulmonary function tests, they do need to be standardized. They need to be performed in a consistent manner. And if not, they lose their usefulness. So I think it's incredibly important that we all standardize and do these things in the same way. We want to know, we use PFTs to determine or to monitor usefulness or effectiveness of therapy. Also in select populations, we use them to evaluate preoperative patients. And just to digress for a minute, and then I promise I'll stick to the topic, but we had a very interesting experience with pre-op pulmonary function testing at Wake Forest Baptist over the past couple of years. What happened basically is we did a study. One of the things that we were asked to do from our general surgeons, they were concerned because their post-op pulmonary function or pulmonary complication rate was higher than it should have been. And it definitely, we found out it definitely was when we took a look. So the question was why, and the question was, well, what can we do about it? So basically what we did was we arbitrarily decided to do pre-screening, pre-operative pulmonary function testing on any patient who was seen in our pre-anesthesia clinic who was 40 years of age or older, who had a smoking history of 40, or let's see, a smoking history of 20 pack years of smoking or more, whether they were symptomatic or non-symptomatic. And interestingly, what we found, just to get to the bottom line, was the patients, we found out that probably about 60% of the patients that we screened had spirometry that was consistent with COPD. We did find some restriction in there too, but the big thing we found was COPD. And about 60% of those patients we screened, we found had undiagnosed obstructive lung disease, certainly on spirometry. What we did then was to go a step further. We went back and we looked at who were the patients who bought more time in the ICU or bought ventilator time. And what we found out was the patients who were buying the ventilators and who were spending the most time in the ICU were not the patients who had a diagnosis of COPD already. They knew they had it and we tested them. They were the people who had the quote unquote undiagnosed COPD. They weren't treated, obviously, and so consequently, they were subject, even though they were asymptomatic prior to their surgery, they bought more time in the ICU and had a higher complication rate. So I think that's one of the areas that we feel like pulmonary function testing really paid off on. Some of the other things that we use them for also are to screen at-risk individuals for pulmonary disease, maybe such as smokers, people with occupational exposure to toxic substances. So occupational exposures, hobbies, things like that. And also to monitor patients for potentially toxic effects of certain drugs and chemicals, things for perhaps like amiodarone, beryllium, and some of those different heavy metals. So as we go forward, when we're talking about pulmonary function tests, I think it's important to have an understanding of just exactly what does that test consist of. So there are three pieces, basically. In addition, I'm not going to talk today about cardiopulmonary exercise testing because that's a whole different, there wouldn't be time. But as far as the static tests, if you will, basically, we have spirometry, we have diffusion capacity, which measures gas transfer, and we have residual volume and total lung capacity. A lot of times, when somebody says the word pulmonary function test, I think the mental picture that pops into our brain is that of spirometry. it's important to keep in mind that spirometry is just a piece of the test. Not every patient needs every test. So it's important to know what it is you're focusing on. So if we look at the top section, you'll see on the top a flow volume loop, and down below is that same test displayed as a time volume curve. So with the flow volume loop, what we're actually doing is we're plotting volume on the horizontal axis, and we're plotting flow on the vertical axis. And anything above that horizontal line or the baseline would be expiratory flow. Anything below that line would be inspiratory flow. And both of those are important to look at. Certainly the expiratory flow gets a lot more attention than the inspiratory, but we'll come back and talk about that a little bit more. So what we're doing with spirometry, the key tests, and excuse me, I'm just getting over a bug myself. So anyway, our key tests or key components, if you look at a pulmonary function report, you're gonna see a whole page, lots and lots and lots of numbers. So what do those things mean? Well, the first thing that I'm gonna suggest that you do is focus on the numbers that are meaningful. And those key numbers are, first of all, the vital capacity, and that may be listed as either a VC or an SVC or FVC. What's the difference? The VC or the SVC is simply a volume measurement without regard to time. So what we're doing there is we're asking the patient to take the deepest breath in they possibly can. Just fill your lungs full all the way, all the way, all the way, and then exhale completely. We're not pushing them to perform the test within a certain amount of time. On the FVC, we're doing essentially the same maneuver, except this time, what we're doing is we're asking the patient to take the deepest, fastest breath in you can, and then force it out just as hard and as fast as you possibly can, but don't stop until you've gotten it all out. Ideally, we would like the patient to be able to sustain that effort for at least 6 seconds. Now, not everybody will, and some patients won't who could, and what I'm saying there is the people who have significant restrictive disease, as many of you know, are not going to be able to sustain that effort for a full 6 seconds. Some people just get tired or distracted or whatever, or are just not used to exerting the effort that it takes, and so they'll cut off their exhalation prematurely. And we'll look at that here in just a few minutes. Okay, then another test or number that's very important, and for those of you in pulmonary rehab who have Medicare patients and you need to deal with the GOLD guidelines, we have this measurement called the FEV1, or forced expired volume of the first second. And so that test is a derivation from the forced vital capacity, or FEV or FVC. And what it is it's a measure of the amount of air that the patient is able to exhale in 1 second. Okay. It does tend to be lower in obstructive diseases, things like COPD and asthma, for instance, and it maybe is a little bit higher in patients with restrictive disease because the lung is stiff and the recoil is greater. The other measurement that we look at is FEV1-FVC ratio, and that's used to help us determine if the patient's pulmonary or spirometric pattern is obstructive, restrictive, or is it normal? And that, of course, is what we're looking at with the GOLD guidelines that we use for pulmonary rehab. And I say that a little bit. For those of you who really follow the GOLD guidelines closely, you know that at the beginning of this year of 2017, we had a revision in the GOLD guidelines. And they basically took out spirometry. Does that mean we don't need to do it? No, it doesn't. But the focus was, and we'll look at them in just a bit, the focus really was on what do we need to do with the patient. So they wanted us to focus more on patient symptoms and gave us more specific guidelines for medications. So that was a change in focus. But for qualifying patients for pulmonary rehab, we still need to use the FVC and the FEV1/FVC ratio. And if you remember, what we're looking for to qualify that patient, it has to be a post-bronchodilator study, okay? And to qualify for coverage under Medicare's pulmonary rehab rule, the FEV1 has to be what? FEV1 volume. Less than 80%. The ratio, the FEV1-FVC ratio, has to be less than 70% post-bronchodilator. Okay? So an FEV1 of less than of less than 80% of predicted with an FEV1-FVC ratio of less than 70% of predicted post-bronchodilator. And that's something, if you're in pulmonary rehab, I'm sure you probably have it tattooed in your brain somewhere, because that's the thing that we absolutely have to go with to get that coverage. So if you have someone who is symptomatic and is referred to pulmonary rehab who doesn't meet those gold guidelines, in other words, they're better than that, what can you do with them? And the reason I'm asking that question is because I still run into this. I think everybody here probably gets it, but we have the respiratory therapy LCD. So what you would do with those folks is you would simply enroll them in the non-pulmonary rehab, or in other words, other respiratory services. So you would bill, you do what you need to do, but you would bill using the old G codes, the G237, 238, and 239. Whereas with the COPD code, somebody who met the gold guidelines and was Medicare, you would bill using the G0424 code. Make sense? Okay, so basically that's what we do there. Okay, so then the next set of tests that we use are the diffusion capacity tests. And those are measured usually, well, you use a tracer gas. The most frequently used gas here in this area is to use a small percentage of carbon monoxide, because in some ways it's very similar to oxygen, in other ways, and it has a much, much higher affinity for hemoglobin than oxygen, so you don't have a back pressure. And I won't go into all the technical details of that test, but the carbon monoxide is the technique that we usually use, and there are several variations there. So what we're really trying to measure with a diffusion capacity test is we're looking for a way of evaluating the gas transfer capability of the lung. So there are times that we would expect to see a decrease in the DLCO, and that DLCO stands for diffusion of the lung for carbon monoxide, and it's measured in milliliters per minute per millimeter of mercury. Conditions where we would expect to see a decreased DLCO would be things, one example would be somebody who's anemic. So that would be a situation where you might see a reduced DLCO, but otherwise no pulmonary disease. So something to keep in mind. And some of the other things would be conditions that would decrease the alveolar capillary surface area of the lung, or decreases the permeability of the lung tissue, such as pulmonary fibrosis. For other tests, there are times that we would expect to see an increase in the DLCO. So think about that in terms of anything that would cause congestion of the pulmonary capillary bed. For instance, heart failure. Sometimes you'll see actually an increased DLCO in heart failure. Okay, and then the next test or series of tests would be those measuring lung capacity, total lung capacity, residual volume. And residual volume, obviously, since that's the amount of gas that stays in the lung at the end of a maximal expiration, that isn't something that we can just catch and measure. What we have to do is to use some sort of indirect method to measure that. And the techniques that we generally use are to either use a tracer gas, something like a nitrogen washout, for any of you that have had the opportunity to use those, or helium dilution, using helium as a tracer gas. Or the other option that is becoming much more common now than it used to be, and that would be body plethysmography, where we're using pressure changes and Boyle's law. For those of you who love gas laws and physics, we are actually using Boyle's law to calculate based on the pressure change, the volume change, and that allows us to measure the total thoracic gas volume. The difference between the gas dilution methods, in other words, the helium and nitrogen washout methods, and the plethysmography, is that plethysmography measures total thoracic gas volume. So any gas that's in the chest will get measured. So if we have an area that is non-communicating, it's gonna measure that. Heaven forbid, if we had a pneumothorax, it would actually measure that volume outside of the lung as well. On the other hand, the gas dilution methods would only measure communicating volume. So if we had an airway that was completely blocked off, then we would not be able to measure, or those methods would not measure any gas that was beyond that area. So those are some of the basic tests. So now let's look at...
It's been doing that randomly. I don't know why. Okay,
I'll just ignore it then. Casper, it's almost Halloween. Maybe he's waiting to visit us. Okay, so we know the basic tests now. So what about the key measurements? What are the things we're going to focus on? Well, that's slow vital capacity, the forced vital capacity, as we mentioned earlier, the FEV1, and the ratio. And if I can digress for just a minute on the ratio, the point I think that's important to make there is that we're actually, when we talk about that FEV1-FVC ratio, and when we're qualifying somebody for pulmonary rehab, the number that we want to look at is the actual FEV1 in liters divided by the actual FVC in liters. The heck with the predicted numbers and all of those percentages. A percentage of a percentage is not what we need to be looking at. And when we were in the midst of the audit purgatory, I'll have to tell you, that was an argument. A lot of us were getting denials because our patients, quote unquote, to use their phrase, did not meet the criteria for the diagnosis. And the reason so many of those patients were getting denied because they didn't meet the criteria for the diagnosis was that the auditors were looking at the percent predicted of the FEV1-FVC ratio, a percent of a percent. So it took a face-to-face interesting meeting with Dr. Feliciano from Palmetto GBA and some of our people from NCCRA, from, well, actually all four states that were in the MACM region Virginia, West Virginia, North and South Carolina. So we actually had a face-to-face with Dr. Feliciano and some of his auditors. And it was really interesting because when it started out, we had some of the auditors were very adamant that no, it was the ratio. And we're saying, no, it's not. You need to read the gold standards. So I had taken a copy of the gold standards with me, thank goodness. And so I just flipped it open, and Dr. Feliciano happened to be sitting right directly across the table from me. So I handed it over to him. And so it kind of went back and forth a little bit. And then on my cell phone, I had my medical director, and I don't know, some of you I know have met her, Jill O'Har. Dr. O'Har is a character on A Good Day. So she's texting me and saying, boy, he sure does like to hear himself talk, doesn't he? So this is going back and forth, and I'm trying to keep a straight face. But she's listening in since she wasn't able to make the meeting. But we had some discussion, I pulled out the gold standards, and then Dr. O'Har came in for the backup attack. Needless to say, after that discussion, they agreed that yes, we will follow the gold standards. We'll use the post-bronchodilator actual FEV1 FVC ratio. So that's how we won that battle. That was a very challenging time for all of us. And I really applaud and congratulate anybody that stuck through those dark days of pulmonary rehab. I'm so glad you're still here. And it certainly was a battle worth fighting. Okay, then another test. This is not something that we need to qualify the patient for Medicare coverage of pulmonary rehab, but I think it's a test that can give you some useful information in terms of taking care of that patient. And that's the peak expiratory flow rate, or PEFR. Okay, why? What does that tell us? That gives us some idea about the patient's cough ability. Does the patient, for whatever reason, can they get enough volume in their lung, and can they move it out fast enough to create enough of a shearing force, to create enough of a velocity to create the shearing force to pull the secretions out of the airways. Another test that is being done more and more frequently, although not uniformly, and I strongly recommend at some point, especially for folks with obstructive disease, that at some point that be measured, and that's a maximal inspiratory flow rate. So it's the same thing as that. We're used to talking about the PEFR with especially asthma, but I think it has other uses too. But the peak inspiratory flow rate also. One of the things that happens, and I'm sure that many of you have heard it before from patients, that medication just really doesn't seem to be working. I can't tell that it's doing me any good. Well, the question that obviously we're all going to be thinking about in that setting is, does the patient, are they using their medication delivery device appropriately? But we need to take it one step further and not only look at their technique, but we also need to be able to understand a little bit about their inspiratory volume and flow rate. Can they take a deep enough breath? Can they take that breath fast enough to break up the particles, if it's a dry powder inhaler, for instance? To really aerosolize it so that they can effectively get the medication down in the parenchyma of the lung where it needs to go. That's not always the case. And taking it still a step further, the next question is, do they have enough reserve so that when they have a sick day and they need that medication the most, how much will that peak inspiratory flow rate drop? Will they still be able to entrain the medicine and get it down into the lung parenchyma? And sometimes we find out that that's not necessarily the case. So as we're teaching these folks in pulmonary rehab to self-manage their disease. I think this is something that we'll be, we can give them as an added benefit. Okay, and then there's another test. We don't focus on it as much as we once did, and that's the forced expiratory flow of 25 to 75%. That's kind of the mid-range of your forced vital capacity. And that's actually, to me, that's your functional lung volume. Because when you're exercising, that's the range of your lung volume that you're actually gonna be using to move, breathing in and breathing out with your exercise. So I think it's helpful to have some idea there too. Okay, now what we're gonna do is we're gonna dive in to the task of interpreting pulmonary function testing. So before we do that, and granted, this is typically done by the physician, but as you and I know, when we're in a pulmonary rehab environment, we need to be able to look at those numbers as well. And we won't always have the information that we need. So we need to be able to decipher it. So before we start to figure out what the issue is that the patient has, the first thing that we need to be sure of is that we have usable, valid information. So we need to confirm, first of all, that the volume time curve reaches a plateau. And if you look on the bottom curve there, notice how big breath in and then the exhalation, it curves out and then it slowly tapers off and flattens out. It's not just absolute flat, but it tapers off, and that effort was sustained for a little bit more, about 10 seconds. So it was sustained for the 6 seconds that we would like to see. Now, if we look, let's see, you don't have it on, maybe this will do it. There we go. Okay, if we look at this curve, we're looking at flow volume loops. Okay, and on this one, this was essentially the same information, but there are a couple of things I'd like for you to look at here that if, and this is one reason why we always need, it's fine to have a set of numbers, but when I'm looking at pulmonary function tests and trying to make sense of them, I always want to see the actual curves if I possibly can, because it gives me a lot of information that I'm not going to get from the numbers. A glance at those curves will tell me, did we get maximal patient effort? And we'll see some other things. So actually, if we look at these, you'll see that this is an acceptable test because these curves are within 200 milliliters of each other for the best efforts. So this would be a test that I think I would feel very comfortable interpreting. Now, these are some errors that do happen a lot, so you need to be aware of those. So if we look at that curve in the upper left-hand corner, that would be what we would like to see. There's a steep exhalation, and then it tapers down, and then we have a maximal inspiration. And notice that that inspiratory leg is nice and rounded, and the loop actually closes. So we have a complete exhalation followed by a complete inhalation. And one of the things that's so important on the inhalation is, remember, you're not going to get out what you don't get in. So if somebody doesn't take a maximal breath in, they're not going to get a maximal FVC. And the problem there is these tests are effort dependent. We want to be sure that we're treating the patient and not the spirometry. Sometimes if we don't get good efforts, it can look like we have things that we don't. And that's a whole different story. Okay, in the next loop, what you'll notice is you'll see three efforts, and back in the back of the room, that might be hard to see, but they're stacked. The top of the curve, we don't get that nice peak that we would like to see. The loop is rounded. So what that means is we really didn't get maximal effort. Okay, the next one as we move over, what you're gonna notice is there's a premature cutoff. And then moving on, we have a cough. And then if we go to the bottom, again, there was a slow takeoff. See how that, and this is the bottom left-hand side for you. Okay, look how that peak expiration leans. It's just, it's almost looks like a tent. It's leaning over. So we don't have a nice sharp rise. And that would, we would expect to see that initial sharp rise even in someone with severe obstructive disease. The next one moving over, what we're actually doing, notice how the expiratory flow stops, but it ends above that baseline. So what's happening there is the patient took a breath in and whew, that was it. We didn't get that small, the slow space gas. So they did not exhale completely. And then as we move on, notice how the inspiratory leg of those loops varies. And then in the last one, in the lower right-hand corner, what we're seeing there is somebody putting their tongue in the mouthpiece. That one is, we don't see it a lot, and a good pulmonary function technologist will pick up on that pretty quickly. One of the places that we will see that fairly often though, or at least an attempt to do that, would be sometimes when we're doing maybe a disability test and somebody is perhaps malingering just a little bit. Again, doesn't happen often, but just something to be aware of. So if you see that, then I would question the values that you're getting, and you might want to ask for a repeat test to confirm the data that you have. Okay, so now we're ready. We've looked at the quality of the test, so we know our data's good. So the next thing then is to start to figure out, what is this thing, what are we going to call it? So the first thing is to look at the FEV1-FVC ratio, okay? And ask yourself the question, is it low? Okay, if the FEV1-FVC ratio is low, and mind you, we're not looking at the FVC, we're not looking at the FEV1, we're looking just at that ratio. If that is less than 70%, and I'm gonna give you some other guidelines here in a minute, that tells us that we do have an obstructive defect. What we are going to focus on in pulmonary rehab will be the GOLD criteria. And just know that there are multiple predicted equations for normal pulmonary function or for pulmonary function tests. So it is helpful to know what criteria is being used. And for cardiac or for pulmonary rehab, we really need to make sure that we're using the GOLD criteria. And GOLD, of course, as we've already discussed, uses a cutoff of less than 70%. Now, just be aware that the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program has a guideline, and that's for patients who are 5 to 18 years of age. They say that any time that FEV1, of course, with good effort, if the ratio is less than 85%, that is consistent with an obstructive defect. So that's a little bit higher than we would use for adults. Okay, another option that we have is to use ATS criteria. And I'm not gonna get bogged down in that right now because that's a discussion for another day. But ATS, there are some times that the ATS criteria is more accurate and identifies more patients with disease. There are other times that GOLD is better. What we know just in summary is that GOLD guidelines are better for patients who are 65 years of age or greater who are symptomatic. That catches, and that's more consistent with patients' reports of symptoms than the ATS criteria. On the other hand, what we know is that the ATS criteria are better for people less than 65 years of age who are asymptomatic, and also for individuals older than 65 years of age who are asymptomatic. So you'll see some of that, and there's still a lot of discussion. And so the next thing then is there's something called the lower limit of normal. I'm not going to get really bogged down into that, but there are some predictive equations that will use lower limit of normal. There are a lot of times we think, okay, 80% is the cutoff of normal. Well, that's great, but that's not the be-all end-all. So when we use the lower limit of normal, what we're looking at is we're comparing the actual patient's value to the fifth percentile that is lowest from the average to determine whether that is normal or not. Okay, so the problem with using the 80% is that depending on the volume, that can vary a little bit more than we would like it to. Okay, and then these are a couple of studies. If you want to follow up on the discussion that we had about the GOLD versus the ATS criteria, these are two good references that talk about that here. If you're bored and want some reading to put you to sleep at night. Okay, and 2017, these are the updated guidelines that came out the end of January of 2017. And I've just tried to summarize, I'm not going to read this to you, but I just tried to summarize this for you very quickly. And again, what basically is, that it says is exactly what we just said. It kind of gives you some guidelines for determining which criteria is better when. In terms of using reference equations, these are just some quick thoughts there. One of the things that I would also caution you about, and the reason I'm dragging you through this is, have you ever had a situation where you see a patient, you know they need to be in pulmonary rehab, they're a Medicare beneficiary, so we know we have to meet those guidelines, but they look sick, they look like you need them, but their numbers are just a little bit too high, they don't quite fit. Well, some other things that you might want to double check. These are some potential sources of error. So one of the things to keep in mind is go back and look at how the predicted values were obtained for that patient. So first of all, height. Was the patient's height actually measured? Was it correct? So you might want to look at your height measurement compared to what's on the pulmonary function report. Was there a keying error when the pulmonary function tech keyed the height in? Another thing that happens sometimes, we don't see this as much in pulmonary rehab, but occasionally I have seen it, and that is you have someone who can't stand to have their height measured. So what can you do then? Anybody know? You measure from the tip of your middle finger across the chest to the tip of the opposite middle finger. I'm sorry, Dave.
I've never encountered that. Why would they not want to have their height measured?
Okay, well, many, many reasons. Let's say some medical condition that prevents What if the patient is a bilateral amputee and doesn't have their braces with them or their prosthetics? Okay, what if they're paralyzed? What if they've had a fracture? There are really a number of situations where that can happen. Not all of which we would see in pulmonary rehab, but I think it's important that we have an alternative to work things out there if we need to. Okay, another thing, and this sounds very, very simple, but honestly, I have had that situation happen several times during the course of my career, and that is look at the sex that is recorded on the predicted, okay? Of course, we all know that women have lower pulmonary predicted values than men. So what if it's a male, and if on the pulmonary function report, sex is recorded as female, what's that gonna do to their predicted values? They're gonna look better than they actually are. So these are just some little tips. And some other guidelines for you, just food for thought. Okay, so the next thing then is to ask yourself, is the FVC low? Okay, so if the FVC is low, the forced vital capacity, then that's suggesting a restrictive element, the possibility of it. We cannot, based on spirometry alone, we can't say, okay, the FVC is 60%. Therefore, this patient has a restrictive defect. We can say it suggests, but the only way we can confirm that that's a restrictive defect is to actually measure total lung capacity, lung volumes. Okay, examples, where could that be off? For instance, somebody has lots and lots of congestion. So airways are obstructed or maybe even non-communicating. That's gonna make the patient look functionally restricted, but they actually will not be. So that would be an example where you might see that. But if we do see the suggestion of restriction on spirometry, ideally that should be followed up with a lung volume measurement. Thank you. I was just looking for that. Total lung capacity. Okay. all right. And this is just an example of a test. This gives you some patterns that you would expect to see for normal, for obstructive, and for restrictive. Okay. So the next thing is, as we mentioned, to confirm the restrictive pattern. And another measurement that would be very helpful in the presence of restriction is to measure the DLCO, okay? Then step four is we need to grade the severity of the abnormality, okay? And this is the grading scale that the American Thoracic Society recommends that we use. So we use the FEV1 percent of predicted to help to determine the severity. And so if that FEV1 percent predicted is greater than 70% but less than 80, then we would say that was a mild defect. 60 to 69 would be moderate, 50 to 59 moderately severe, 35 to 49 would be severe, and less than 35, of course, would be very severe. Okay, we next, and this is key for pulmonary rehab for Medicare coverage, determine reversibility of the obstructive defect. So we need to see a post-bronchodilator study. And what we consider to be a significant improvement in an adult post-bronchodilator would be an increase of 12% or more in the FEV1 or FVC predicted, and an increase, both of them together, not just one, an increase of 200 milliliters or more in adults. Okay, Defects that are fully reversible suggest asthma. Asthma is about the only thing that's going to be fully reversible. If it's partially reversible, then we would begin to think about COPD or chronic bronchitis, something that sort of pattern. If we see a mixed pattern, and if the FVC corrects to greater than 80% in patients 5 to 18, or to the lower limit of normal in an adult, that patient is likely to have obstructive lung disease with air trapping. Okay, so just a couple of little pearls there. All right, and this would be a good study pre and post bronchodilator. The red curve would be the pre and the green curve would be the post. But see how that corrects? Okay, now, another test that is sometimes that if patients complain of shortness of breath with exertion or wheezing, then you think exercise-induced asthma. So we can do, there are a number of chemical agents that can be used to provoke bronchospasm. And folks who have asthma, their airways are more reactive, so they're going to respond at an earlier state. So the most commonly used agent in this locality tends to be methacholine. Then other things that are sometimes used would be mannitol. Exercise testing is sometimes used where we do a baseline spirometry and then we exercise the patient and repeat the spirometry. Or another test that is sometimes used is called eucapnic voluntary hypertonia, where we give the patient a gas mixture to breathe, where we've standardized the oxygen concentration and the carbon dioxide level, and we have the patient breathe in and out, similar to performing maximal voluntary ventilation. We can also do a cold air challenge. And if the FEV 1% is less than 70%, then we might want to do a bronchodilator treatment to determine how much reversibility we have. So then finally, the last step is to establish the differential diagnosis. Again, I'm not going to read all of these to you, but our possibilities are normal or obstructive lung disease, where we're going to see airflow limitation. We might see increased lung volumes with some air trapping, or normal or increased compliance. For restrictive disease, we would expect to see reduced lung volumes. Also an increase in the overall stiffness of the lung. In other words, it's more work for the patient to take a breath to expand that lung, or in other words, decreased compliance. And below that, I've given you some examples. Typical or very common obstructive diseases would be things like asthma, bronchitis, or COPD. Restrictive diseases would be things like beryllium disease, congestive heart failure, pulmonary fibrosis, and the list goes on. Thoracic deformities would be another. Okay, this is just for your information, for your reference, to give you some ideas of what you would expect to see in some conditions. And I'm not going to read through that. You can read that when you have a minute. And this is just the schematic that we went through, a summary of that as far as the thought process that we use to interpret those pulmonary function tests. This is the new GOLD guideline. And notice it uses an ABCD grading scale. The interesting thing about it is that treatment is based on frequency and severity of symptoms. And there are a couple of very, very good articles, and you can pull up the GOLD data. If anyone has problems accessing it, let me know, and I'll be happy to help you. But there are some very good treatment guidelines there. If you haven't seen those, to guide you. This is just a schematic for using that ABCD assessment tool. Okay? And with that, I think everybody's probably getting tired of sitting. So these are some references. I'm gonna stop here and try to answer any questions anyone may have. Yes?
Timing of the PFT prior to entry, is there any guidelines? It's gotta be within a certain period?
That's a great question. And I'm sorry I didn't think to mention that at the beginning. And that question comes up a lot. The answer to that question, and I am going to quote Dr. Feliciano from Palmetto GBA, since he is the medical director of Medicare in our region for most of us, and he said, there is no time limit. The study is acceptable as long as it is clinically relevant. Okay. There are, by the way, some MAC regions that do have, I think there are a couple that do have time limits on their PFTs. But no, here in this region, as long as that test is considered by the patient's physician to be clinically relevant, even if it was done 5 years ago. Now, personally, I think there's value from a clinical perspective of having a test performed within the last year, or if there have been big changes maybe in the last 6 months. But, and I think it can help us guide our treatment plan for those patients. But in terms of meeting Medicare criteria, as long as it's clinically relevant, there is no time limit. Okay? Any other questions? Well, it's been great to be with you. I'm gonna go ahead and stop right here. And if you do have questions later, don't hesitate to catch me.
Thank you.